Frank Langella has been an actor for over 50 years. On stage, he's played everyone from Count Dracula to Richard Nixon, although perhaps that statement minimizes his range. Over the years, he's rubbed shoulders with just about everyone, and as we have learned in his delicious, somewhat dishy memoir, appropriately called Drop Names. The chapters are named by celebrity and include Laurence Olivier, Paul Newman, Marilyn Monroe, Tip O'Neill, among many others, and they're arranged in the chronological order of their subjects' deaths. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Frank Langella back to our show. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. Nice to be with you again.
I'm assuming that you meant your title Drop Names to be a bit of a double entendre because all of the people you profile are no longer with us.
Yes, they are. I'm dropping their names and they've dropped dead.
Was that your choice or was that something you did on the advice of your lawyers?
No, it was my choice. I wrote it long before a lawyer ever saw it.
Yeah. But the fact that they're no longer with us may have helped you be so honest about things.
Yeah, well, the fact that they're no longer with us was important for me because I wanted it to be a memory book. I wanted it to be a book about people, fascinating, extraordinary people that I began meeting when I was 15.
Is it also that you're at a point in your life as an actor and as a person that you're confronting your own issues of mortality and legacy?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And the book has so many stories of people who are coming towards the ends of either their careers or their lives, and it was an enormous lesson to me about all of us about how do you handle the decades as they get into the later decades? How much of the fundamental things in life start to become terribly important to you? And the people in the book who weren't able to get there were the ones who had the most difficult and painful ends, it seems to me. But it's not about all their ends always. It's about the interactions with them since I was 15.
Well, you write about doing a play with Deborah Carr while your star was rising and hers was falling. How do you feel looking back on that experience?
With Deborah?
Well, just that, you know, she had been such a huge star, and her only crime was that she was getting on in years.
Well, Deborah gave up movies because she didn't like the advent of sex and violence, and she literally decided not to make films anymore, and she was having a Broadway career. But she's indicative of, when you think about the people, I started in 1960. The very first person I met by happenstance was Marilyn Monroe in 1953. But I still had to go to school and finish school.
Was she already Marilyn Monroe at the time?
Yes, in 1953 she was at the height of her fame.
Because mm-hmm. Tony Curtis talks about meeting her before either of their names were changed.
Yeah, she was in 1953 was the 7-year itch, and I think John would prefer blondes.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these people was. It's interesting if you're a young actor at 21 or 22, and you suddenly find yourself in a room with icons of all kinds, from George C. Scott to the Queen Mother to, you know, Laurence Olivier.
Well, how does that work? I've always wondered about this. Are you able to find the person beyond the fantasy? If you're with Cary Grant, is he always the Cary Grant, the charming man you've met in through the movies, or can he ever just be Cary Grant? Or a better example is Rita Hayworth, somebody you did know.
I didn't know Cary Grant.
But Rita Hayworth, you know, she talked about people confusing the Rita Hayworth on the screen with the real person.
But that is generally true at the end. I wrote about 85 or 90 people, actually close to 100, and then I whittled it to 66. I could say that there is a very strong theme that says no one is their image. No one. Everybody has a persona they put on, even unconsciously. Most people put it on consciously. When I go into a room or do a movie or a television show or talk on a radio show, I'm going to have a certain persona. And sometimes it's unconscious and sometimes it isn't. But going through this many people in my lifetime, I got more and more aware of the wide difference between the image and the person. Rita, the first paragraph of Rita says, never have I met anyone further from her image than Rita Hayworth.
But she was already having memory lapses.
Yeah.
Was this early onset?
It was early onset. When I knew her, it wasn't full-blown yet.
You talk about creating your own persona, as you say, everybody does. I would assume in some cases it's conscious, in other cases they believe their own image, don't they?
Yes, many. I found the most fascinating were the women in the book. Men, many men too, but the women and what they have to deal with towards the end of their lives and how they have to handle their aging and the loss of their beauty or even the loss of their popularity.
Well, we have Charlton Heston, who you kind of suggest thought he could actually part the sea.
Yes, he could.
And Yul Brynner thought he actually was a king.
Yes.
And insisted that his limo would be brought into the theater so he wouldn't have to deal with the fans outside.
Yeah, he didn't like the public very much, not at all.
Well, what happens when you come out the stage door and there are these people lined up to
stop,
get your autograph?
You stop and you are, I think, as welcoming and open as you can be because they're the reason you're on the stage in the first place.
Before we move on, I was thinking about another story you tell about people getting older. You will never get old, of course, Frank.
Oh, sure.
You recall asking John Gielgud once why he traveled halfway around the world to appear in a cameo part in a movie where he got his throat slit. What did he tell you?
Well, he used the word garrotted, which I think is a fabulous word. I'm here to do a little scene, darling, where I get garrotted. Who else says things like that? He gave me a piece of advice. I was then a young leading man, and he said, because I teased him and said, why are you playing this one scene? And he said, when you get to be my age, dear, you'll only be offered small scenes. Take them only if they're effective. And it was a brilliant piece of advice, because at my age now, although lately I'm very lucky, I've been still playing leading roles in films, but every once in a while I'll get offered a wonderful, juicy part, and I always look to see if it's effective, if it lands, if it isn't just a CEO behind a desk giving orders.
Or something where you just are doing a job.
Yeah, we are the guy with white hair.
But in going through this book, I wondered if you were out to settle scores or make amends in some instances.
Never out to settle scores, never spiteful, never in any way did I feel when writing it that I was trying to pay somebody back. I'm an actor, therefore I observe. And I didn't know until I started writing it, which I did by beginning with Jill Clayburgh, because she died so young and I wanted to record my memories of her. In certain instances, I did want to say I wished I'd been less of a callow young man and spent more time with Deborah, more time with other people in the book, that I was young and energetic and living in my own generation and stuff. But I absorbed so much of them, so I was able to do it now and write about them.
Well, in some cases, readers will be surprised. You say that Paul Newman was dull, and Bancroft was narcissistic.
Narcissistic to say about an actor is narcissistic is so redundant. You know, I could have said it about every subject in the book, very much including myself.
They all look in mirrors.
Narcissism is part of this profession, but the book is, I think, 60% actors and 40% socialites, Broadway, politicians, presidents, and things.
Are these the kinds of stories that actors share with fellow actors?
Yeah.
Are you violating that code by sharing them with civilians?
No, I hope I'm enhancing a civilian's life. There is a magical, extraordinary, unique, and original, if that's really overstating it, it probably is, but in the world of the theater, in the world backstage, it's a very charged life to be an actor. And if you're lucky enough to be successful, you find yourself suddenly in Queen of England's box at a race. You find yourself sitting opposite a president for lunch, or you find yourself in the most extraordinary places.
I've only had this experience with musicians, but when they get together, they often tell incredible stories about gigs that they had in the past. Yeah. And I get the feeling from this book that actors do the same sort of thing.
Well,
and there's a can you top this aspect to it.
Well, that's what the preface says, which just began because I was sitting with a group of actors in a dressing room, and somebody just kept dropping a name constantly. So I picked up a piece of silverware, flung it to the floor and said, oh, dear, I dropped something. And it became a joke that every time we mentioned a famous name, somebody flung a fork across the room.
But this is partly because people are meeting each other for a moment, and then they move on. In fact, you say that the life of an actor is packing and unpacking suitcases and joining happy and unhappy families for finite periods of time. Yeah. So you don't know these people, and then suddenly you're in this very intimate situation, and you have to tell them as much about yourself as you can.
It's
they try very, to tell you as much about
it's
themselves.
It's very, very charged and at very high energy. Actors live at an enormously high energy. Anybody in pressured circumstances do. The young woman I referred to, who I lived with in the 60s, my first very long-term relationship, was a nurse. And she would come home from the 12 o'clock shift and tell me about all the sexual exploits going on between the nurses and the residents because, you know, they were dealing with death and blood and agony all the time, and the only way they could deal with it was to have crawl off into corners as often as they could. Actors live in that a different kind of world. They're not dealing with death, but they're dealing with highly charged emotions.
And they often have affairs as well.
Oh, constantly.
Yeah. Often when they are away from their spouses on location somewhere. And
you know the expression, don't you? I love you, baby, but the show closed.
Well, a well-known actor told me a story about an affair on the show. I'm not going to mention names. But he had this affair with this incredible actress. And when he came back, she returned to her husband. He returned to his wife. And he just assumed that it had been a location romance, even though he thought he fell in love with her. He didn't know that she took it a lot more seriously, and it had caused her a lot of trouble, and she was upset that he never called.
I think probably the best of all possible worlds is when an actor and actress, or an actor and an actor, or an actress and an actress, I don't make any judgments on any of that. When they meet, they know they're on location for a brief period of time. They're attracted to each other, and then they know it's going to be over when they go back home.
You had a number of situations like that with women who are older than you.
Mm. I went through a period, I didn't know this until I wrote the book. Somewhere in the 70s, between my two major relationships, long-term relationships, I seem to have had about a five-year period of being very attracted to older women.
Do you know why that was?
Sure, but you don't have a couch in here.
Frank Langella has written a book called Drop Names, Famous Men and Women as I Knew Them, a memoir. It is published by Harper. Your chapter on your former agent, David Begelman, and your reaction to his suicide are rather revealing. Now, I remember the scandal. For a while, he was running Columbia Pictures.
Yeah.
And then he was caught.
He forged a $10,000 check that was meant to go to the actor Cliff Robertson. Cliff found out about it, turned him in. Cliff was back blackballed in Hollywood, and David was made president of a film company. So it gives you a good idea of the moral level of my profession, particularly in Hollywood.
But then he committed suicide.
He did many, many years later, mm-hmm. many years later.
Are you still angry with him?
No, I was never angry with him.
Were you aware of that kind of behavior?
Sure. It's not unusual in this profession. You know, hello, he lied is the story about your agent calling you on the phone.
A few of the most remarkable encounters you had during your life began when you were quite young and a theater apprentice. One of your fellow apprentices invited you to her house for lunch. And who else was coming?
I was 23. The dinner guests, the luncheon guests, were Jack Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, Noel Coward, and Fred Astaire's sister, Adele, myself, Liza, the young girl, and her parents, who were Bunny and Paul Mellon. This, to a young 23-year-old boy from New Jersey, was extraordinary because she didn't tell me either who her parents were or who the guests were.
And Bunny Mellon was a friend of Jackie
yes,
Kennedy's.
Yes, our best friend, yeah.
This is one of the most satisfying chapters in the book because your experience with Noel Coward is exactly as we would have imagined it in our fantasies.
Yeah.
He really was that way in real life?
There are. I actually will contradict myself now because earlier in our conversation I said almost no one is their image. But Sir Noel was completely what you would expect him to be. Absolutely in every way, shape, or form.
Did he flirt with you?
Oh, outrageously, sure. You know.
What were your impressions of the Kennedys?
Well, I was 23. He was president of the United States. It was the height of Camelot. He only had another 27 months to live. And I think it's one of the most magical afternoons of my life, and I can still recall it vividly. And I tried to capture it through the eyes of this 23-year-old boy.
And Jack Kennedy got on the table and danced?
Yes. Sir Noel was playing all of his music from a Broadway musical he was doing called Sail Away. Jackie was completely well-versed in all of his music, sang along. And at one point, Adele Astaire pushed all the magazines off the coffee table and said to Jack, who was in yellow pants, to the president, excuse me, come on and dance with me. And I watched.
Dancing with Adele Astaire must have been a thrill for him.
Yeah. The two of them did a soft shoe on the coffee table while Noel Coward and Jackie sang I'll See You Again, at one of the great songs. It's a wonderful memory for me.
Well, you seem to have known Jackie for a long time. She appears in several of these stories.
Yeah.
And at times we've sympathized with her. Other times she doesn't come across all that well.
Well, I don't think she comes across badly. She comes across as a woman who knew exactly where she was in her life and where she was in the world's view. Strong, very, very centered, very, very certain of herself, very aware of what her image is. I liken her to the Wizard of Oz. Her balloon landed in a place, and the populace said, "You're a wizard," and she accepted the role.
Well, she was married to a man who she knew was cheating on her, and then she married somebody else who people found rather dislikable, Aristotle Onassis. On the other hand, she became a very respected book editor.
Yeah. She had enormous, enormous inner strength, tremendous amount of discipline.
In most memoirs, the writer, I, is the protagonist, but you're very much in the wings in this. We learn about you mostly through your reactions, and you're kind of a stand-in for us as we learn a lot about these other people, but very little about your personal life. Is that because you are a private person, or because you just saw this book as being something different?
Well, I'm at such a different time in my life now. I think when you get older, and I'm 74, you have a sort of either conscious or unconscious desire to be known as you're getting closer to the whatever the end is. And also, you have my choice to put myself in the supporting player's position was because as I was writing about each person, which I did 5 in the morning till about 7 a.m., I was learning about myself as I was writing it, and I was trying to tell the reader, look, when I was in a room with the president, I was 23, so I felt differently than I do now, but I tried to write it as the 23-year-old was thinking it.
How disillusioning is contact with some of these people? I once worked backstage for a production with Rex Harrison. Everybody hated the man. some years back, Peter Ustinov told me that when Laurence Olivier pointed out the dead spots in a particular stage, he was unsure whether Sir Laurence was really giving him good advice or trying to sabotage him when he appeared on that stage.
Oh. Yeah, that's but it sounds like Larry. It does. Yeah.
So these are, I mean, why would these great actors have to be so dislikable? They had wonderful lives and wonderful careers.
Because before you're a great actor, before you're a great ballerina, before you're a great politician, you're a human being. And you're a human being who has formulated certain defenses and certain necessary qualities to survive. You know, and most people, when you get to be iconic, treat you that way. So it gets harder and harder for them to stay humans, just straightforward humans.
We can't get to Anthony Quinn, Princess Diana, also Kirk Douglas, wonderful stories on all of these people, Stella Adler. But they're all included in Frank Langella's new book called Drop Names, Famous Men and Women as I Knew Them. And Frank Langella will be in conversation with Karen James at the 92nd Street Y coming up on April 1st at 7:30. By the way, his book is published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Always a pleasure, Leonard. Very strange to be talking about a book and not a part in a play.